Okay, welcome to Health Writers. I'm MJ LaPlay. Tonight we start the show off with a pre-recorded piece, and then we're going to talk with Professor Al Giddits of UW La Crosse. Earlier today I spoke with Mike McCormick. He's with the Ohio Department of Natural Resources. He is a permit manager and of the Oil and Gas Division of the Mineral Resources Management Department. Ohio Valley Energy Systems Corporation was sued last week by an insurance company that represents families who were displaced due to a gas leak that entered their homes and damaged their water supplies. This is in Bainbridge, Ohio. And McCormick, he's going to explain to us about, right at the beginning of the interview, how many wells have been drilled in Ohio?
To date, there's been approximately 275,000 wells drilled in the state of Ohio. In fact, there's only three states in the country with more wells drilled. That's Texas, Oklahoma, and Pennsylvania. The most recent information I have for 2008, there were 1,075 wells drilled in the state. 2009, there'll be about 550. So there's only going to be about half of what was drilled in 2008. And that would be related to supply and demand and also prices of oil and gas. In 2008, for instance, the oil and gas prices were both record highs for Ohio. Oil sold for an average of $93.79 a barrel, and natural gas sold for $9.77 a thousand cubic feet. Probably 2010 is going to be pretty close, probably around 600 wells drilled. Now, regarding your question about urban drilling, it's actually a pretty interesting question because, as I mentioned, oil and gas drilling has occurred in Ohio going back to 1860, and it's been in urban areas actually for decades, if not over the past century. We have cities in Ohio, Akron, Cleveland, Youngstown, Warren, which are some of the larger ones. They've had wells drilled in them way before my agency was established, which was in 1965. In fact, actually, the creation of the regulatory permitting agency in 1965 was based on the outgrowth of urbanized drilling in Morrow County, which is in the county just north of Columbus. Back then, they called it town lot drilling, but literally, they had drilling rigs almost in everyone's yard. They had a drilling rig. You could almost jump from rig to rig to rig to rig. The problem with that, it wasn't a good conservation of resources because it would be like putting 10 straws in a glass. So everyone's drinking out of the same glass, the law of capture, and basically whoever put the straw in the glass first got the majority of it, and then as you continued to drill around there, you'd get some. And so they changed it from the law of capture. With the creation of my agency, they started having spacing, which was based on acreage and distances, in order to try to, you know, let one well do the job instead of 10 wells.
Mineral resources management went from local control to state control.
There was a bill passed in 2004 called the so-called Urbanized Area Drilling Bill. And the reason that bill was introduced and passed in Ohio, a number of local communities had established health and safety ordinances that had particular distances from structures or natural features, and the industry, as well as citizens, wanted some clear standards on regulations, one consistent standard for the state. The passage of House Bill 278, which became effective in 2004, removed local authority to establish setback distances, and instead, the Department of Natural Resources became the sole agency responsible for establishing setbacks and enforcing oil and gas law.
Since the new law, who applies for drilling permits?
It's been kind of interesting because applications or permits for wells on churches, schools, municipal property, shopping centers, apartment complexes, where all these wells have been permitted, and it's because those various entities I just mentioned to you decided to sign a lease. There's still local authority because if locally people don't sign leases, there isn't wells.
Is there a financial incentive to sign a lease?
Yes, there is. When a school has a well put on their property, they receive free gas. They also receive a mini $1,000 signing bonus for having the well drilled on their property. Plus, they receive royalties. Some of the areas they're drilling these wells in have not really been drilled in before, and so that you're getting pretty much virgin oil and gas type production, which can mean $50,000 to $100,000 or more for that particular entity in a year. That particular money is what is called a royalty interest. It's typically 1/8 of the production, because the operator, these wells may cost $400,000 to drill, so the operator, the oil and gas company, bears the cost.
What do the permits require?
Wherever we receive an application for a permit, we can look at our studies and know, okay, the freshwater in this area is be 400 feet. Now, they may be actually shallower wells, but we protect the deepest freshwater in an area, require surface casing, which is steel casing, to be set at least 50 feet below that deepest freshwater. So in this example, the deepest freshwater is 400 feet. We would require 450 feet of surface casing.
Surface casing.
And that's cemented back to surface. So they drill their well about 450 feet, and then they run typically about 9-inch steel casing, about 30-foot joints. They screw it together and lower it down the hole. Then what they do is they run a calculated volume of cement down the middle of the casing, and when it reaches the bottom of the hole, it's forced up around the outside of the hole back to surface.
Oil and gas inspectors are on the site.
Oil and gas inspectors for every county of the state, highest priorities for them is to be present during the running of the casing and cementing of the casing to make sure once the cement's dried, then they can begin to drill down the middle with a smaller drill bit. They go down the middle of that surface casing and go on down to their geologic formation. Therefore, if they encounter oil and gas, as it comes up the hole, it's prohibited from getting into the groundwater.
A well in Bainbridge, Ohio, soon after construction in the year 2007, leaked gas. Mike McCormick of the Ohio Department of Natural Resources explains what his department did immediately.
One thing that was immediately done is we looked into what the problem was, why this happened, and developed permit conditions for all subsequent wells in that area and generally the northeast part of the state. I think that covered about 5 counties. And so we immediately, retroactively, to wells that had been permitted but not drilled, and forward applied these permit conditions. And those conditions, I don't have them in front of me, but they put a lot of checks and balances into the process. We weren't out there. Our inspector was not out there during the cementing of that casing. It actually wasn't the surface casing. There's a second string of casing they put in the well called production casing, and that's the casing that had the bad cement job on it. Well, we weren't present during that. Require, for instance, in those conditions, we require notification before they do that. It wasn't required before.
Is there a point when it's all drilled up?
Sure. Yes. The answer is yes. In these areas, the minimum amount of acreage required is 20 acres, and it can be as much as 40 acres. It's according to depth. Basically, the principle is the deeper the well is, the more acreage you need. And so these particular pieces in a lot of the urban areas are either 20 or 40. So you have to amass at least a 20-acre unit. I've seen 20 or 40-acre units with over 100 landowners signing leases, and those landowners might only own a tenth or a quarter, 0.25 of an acre. You have 80 people that own about a quarter of an acre, and that's how you get your acreage. So these companies have gone out and talked to 20, 50, 100 different landowners, got them to sign leases in order just to drill a unit.
Mike McCormick explains the Ohio Department of Natural Resources Division of Mineral Resources Management's mission.
First and foremost, we're the oil and gas regulatory agency,
right.
So we're not promoting drilling, and we're not, in a sense, discouraging it. We're the legislators in Ohio have passed a statute which we enforce, and so our primary mission is allowing oil and gas and or other mineral resources to be produced, but done in a way that's safe to the environment and public health and safety. So the law allows people to do this, and so we're just going to make sure that they follow the law and it's done in an environmentally safe way.
Okay, next we will talk with Professor Al Giddens, who teaches at the University of Wisconsin-La Crosse. He is a longtime activist in environmental and native solidarity movements, author of The New Resource Wars, Native and Environmental Struggles Against Multinational Corporations, and Resource Rebels, Native Challenges to Mining and Oil Corporations. He is currently the Executive Secretary of the Wisconsin Resources Protection Council and the Director of the Center for Alternative Mining Development Policy. Hello, Professor.
Hello.
Hi, thanks for joining us tonight.
My pleasure.
Okay, I wonder, did you hear some of the interview?
I heard the last couple minutes.
Last couple minutes. It was kind of long, so... And so basically, tonight, the listeners have heard one part of the story in terms of drilling, and I wonder if you can go a little bit further and teach us more about, to start with, about mineral rights and surface rights. Oh, and also drilling rights.
Well, historically, mineral rights are part of the property package that comes with any piece of property. Which means that the surface owner may or may not own the mineral rights. Most people, unless they have some reason to believe that their property is contains valuable minerals or oil or gas, are not aware of the distinction. And so what happens is that if they do not own the mineral rights, whoever buys the mineral rights or whoever had the mineral rights before they became the surface landowner, if there are valuable subsurface deposits of minerals or oil and gas, the mineral rights owner has the predominant estate, which means that the surface owner has to either accept the terms of the offered by the mineral estate owner, or the mineral rights owner can simply go ahead and extract the resources regardless of the surface owner's permission. So the surface owner essentially is in a position where they own the first 3 feet of topsoil, and everything else is owned by the mineral estate owner. Here in Wisconsin, during the period of settlement, the primary beneficiaries of mineral rights were railroad companies who were given mineral rights as an incentive to lay railroad track by the federal government, and consequently a lot of mining in northern Wisconsin is proposed for lands where the surface owner does not own the mineral rights. In fact, there was a big debate when there was a flurry of interest in mineral activity in Wisconsin in the 1970s, 1980s, which brought up the problem that the state wasn't even taxing the owners of those mineral rights, and so this is a situation which only becomes a political issue and a contentious issue when there is mineral or oil and gas activity.
And so, back to the state of Ohio, in the report that we just heard, there is a local authority over drilling rights has been taken away and gone to the state level. Can you talk about that? Does that happen in Wisconsin? That is,
there isn't any oil and gas activity in Wisconsin.
There
were some proposals back in the 1980s in Bayfield County around Lake Superior, but that never developed into an oil extraction project. So the state really has no experience with oil and gas regulation. But the Department of Natural Resources does have authority over mineral exploration and mining, and we've had a number of very dramatic examples of where the state has essentially been pressured by the mining industry to be less protective of the public interest in the environment and in public water supplies when it comes to a conflict between the interests of the mining company, as in the case of the Kennecott mine in Ladysmith, or the Exxon proposed mine in Crandon, where the State Department of Natural Resources failed to execute its statutory authority to fully investigate the impacts of proposed mining and to regulate it in a way that protects the public interest in those resources. In the case of the Kennecott mine in Ladysmith, the first impact statement that was submitted to for public review was an impact statement which was essentially plagiarized by the Department of Natural Resources from the company's own technical impact statement. In a subsequent impact statement, the State Department of Natural Resources failed to follow up recommendations of its own Bureau of Endangered Resources, which said that before the impact statement could be issued, they needed to survey the Flambeau River, where the Kennecott mine was proposed, to survey the area for endangered resources. They didn't do the survey, and then when the department issued the environmental impact statement, the public was led to believe, quite erroneously, that there were no endangered species in the river. Later on, after the permit was issued, endangered species were discovered in the Flambeau River, and Lacouture Chippewa Tribe and the Sierra Club sued the state of Wisconsin for failing to conduct a proper environmental impact statement and got a court order to stop the mine construction until a proper environmental impact statement was done. So this is not exceptional. In the history of mining in the United States, state agencies, regulatory agencies, have essentially been overwhelmed at the financial and political power of the mining companies, and unless there is a countervailing organization of citizens, in the case of Wisconsin, tribal interests, the tendency is for these regulatory agencies to neglect their statutory responsibility to protect the environment and to protect human health.
Right, because I asked about, it's not in the interview, but I did ask, you know, since the state has taken over, this is back to Ohio, the Bainbridge incident where the water, the methane gas got into the houses and into the water supply. And they don't issue impact statements. So when are impact statements made?
When they are required by law.
And so there is no law there for that.
In the case of the oil and gas industry, we have a quite exceptional situation where under the Bush administration, when oil and gas was a very favorite industry by the administration,
right,
the industry was exempted from regulation under the Safe Drinking Water Act. The Safe Drinking Water Act is designed to protect the underground sources of water, which are the drinking water supplies for over half of the United States population. And so if the law provides an exemption for the industry, then there's not a whole lot of oversight that can be provided by state regulators because they don't have the authority to require the companies to disclose what kind of water supply they may be impacting. They don't need to disclose to the public what kind of chemicals they're injecting into those water supplies. And in case after case, we have examples all over the United States of these chemicals that are used in this process of hydraulic fracturing, where water and sand and chemicals are injected into these underground wells to fracture the rock and force the natural gas into pockets that can be extracted. One of the byproducts of that fracturing process is that these chemicals contaminate underground water supplies. And even if there are, you know, restricted areas where the hydraulic fracturing takes place, we have all sorts of examples of where, in over half of these cases, the chemicals that are injected in one place end up in another place in the aquifer and contaminate public water supplies. So here we have a case of an industry which is a very well-organized, financed, heavily lobbied industry, which has exempted itself from regulation under requirements that would ordinarily result in them having to produce an environmental impact statement,
right,
which can be evaluated and challenged by people that may be affected by the activities of those companies.
And so will that change, you think, post-Bush administration?
Well, there is a bill in Congress right now to put oil and gas hydraulic fracturing activity under the authority of the Safe Drinking Water Act. And if that occurs, a couple of things will take place, one of which is that they will need to disclose what chemicals they are injecting, mm-hmm, and also whether those chemicals are cancer-causing or toxic or need to be disposed of as hazardous waste. And if they do meet the category of being hazardous waste materials, the oil and gas companies will have to take responsibility for recovering those chemicals after they've been injected into those underground formations.
Wow. And then, as part of the research I was studying, that sometimes then the hazardous waste gets injected in deep into the earth.
Exactly.
And then, earthquakes. That's what happened in northeast Ohio. Is there one more thing? Can you please talk about the sulfite mining?
The northern Wisconsin, northern Michigan, upper peninsula Michigan, and northeastern Minnesota are all being targeted by mining companies that are interested in base metals, copper, gold, nickel, that are in sulfide deposits, which means that the copper and the zinc and the nickel are embedded in rocks, which, when brought to the surface and exposed to air and water, those sulfide minerals become sulfates. They react chemically with the air and the water, and those acidic reactions, called acid mine drainage, then leach out or liquefy other heavy metals in the waste rock, like cadmium, mercury, arsenic, and even copper, and discharge those heavy metals into local water supply. When those chemicals, heavy metals, are discharged into the local water supplies, they are toxic to aquatic organisms, including fish, and in many cases, those sulfates make available to the environment naturally occurring mercury, inorganic mercury, transform that inorganic mercury into methyl mercury, which is the mercury that shows up in the fish that we eat, and that makes the fish inedible, and which makes consuming fish with high levels of mercury a toxic health hazard. So these are all well-established risks of metallic sulfide mining, and they're exacerbated because all of these environments, northern Wisconsin, Michigan, and Minnesota, are very water-rich environments where those chemicals are going to be released into.
And so you're helping with the organization of the closing down of those mines?
Well, we are providing information about the hazards associated with metallic sulfide mining and assisting various both citizen and tribal organizations in challenging the claims of the mining companies that this is a safe activity and that there will be no environmental or human health harms that result from those activities.
And where can people learn more about that?
The best place to go is the Wisconsin Resource Protection Council website, which is www.wrpc.net.
WRPC?
WRPC, as in Wisconsin,
yes,
Resource Protection Council.
Okay, thanks, .net. Okay, Al Gooditz, thank you for joining us this evening and teaching us so much. And can we talk to you later in the year?
Yeah, no problem.
Okay, all right. Have a good evening.
Thank you.
All right, bye-bye. And then I'm going to give a little couple healthy bits and pieces. On Wednesday, January 20th at 7 p.m., the UW-Madison Memorial Union, you can hear Molly Stentz, our very own news director from WORT, and John E. Peck. He's the executive director of Family Farm Defenders, and he was an observer for La Via Campesina when they were in Copenhagen. The two were in Copenhagen, and so they're going to give back a report back from Copenhagen about the reclaiming power, pushing for climate justice. Also, there's a workshop on Feldenkrais method. It's going to be at the Willie Street Co-op, and that's going to be Monday the 18th from 6 to 8 p.m. Sandy River will teach people about how to do many things, release tension, stiffness, and back pain all through movement. She's going to teach this. She's been a student of this method for 20 years. So you can stop in at the Willie Street Co-op. And my name is MJ LaPlay. I've been your host for Health Writers this evening. I want to thank the Rainier family for engineering and answering the phone and the food before the show. And also up next is going to be Radio Lit. And have a good evening.
Oh, help me, please, doctor. I'm damaged. There's a pain where there once was a heart. It's sleeping, it's a fainting.